Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati and Jetta's Grove, Anathan Pindika's park. Then, when it was evening, the Venerable Mahakohita rose from meditation, went to the Venerable Sariputta, and exchanged greetings with them. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One. Now, Mahakohita had students with him, and so did Sariputta. Mahakohita was one of the very famous monks, and he was foremost in meditation. Which means he was always sitting. One who is unwise is said, friend, with reference to what was this said, one who is unwise. Now, Mahakohita knew the answers to these questions, but he asked for the students. One does not wisely understand, friend, that's why it is said, one who is unwise. And what doesn't one wisely understand? One doesn't wisely understand this is suffering. Now, it doesn't say life is suffering, and an awful lot of people will say that all life is suffering. But it says this is suffering, which is referring to the different links of dependent origination. One does not wisely understand, or one does not wisely understand, this is the origin of suffering. One does not wisely understand, this is the cessation of suffering. One does not wisely understand, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. One does not wisely understand, friend. That is why it is said, one who is unwise. I think with this group I did read how there's the Four Noble Truths in each link, right? No? Okay. Then let's do that. Okay, this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, Ascetics and Brahmins. Monks, as to those ascetics and Brahmins who do not understand these things, that is the First Noble Truth. The origin of these things, the cessation of these things, the way leading to the cessation of these things. What are the things they do not understand, whose origin they do not understand, whose cessation they do not understand, and the way leading to whose cessation they do not understand? They do not understand aging and death. First Noble Truth. Second Noble Truth, its origin. Third Noble Truth, its cessation. Fourth Noble Truth, the way leading to its cessation. They do not understand birth, habitual tendency, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, sixth sense base, mentality, materiality, consciousness, and formations, their origin, their cessation, and way leading to their cessation. These things they do not understand, whose origin they do not understand, whose cessation they do not understand, the way leading to the cessation they do not understand. These I do not consider to be ascetics among ascetics or Brahman among Brahmins. These venerable ones do not, by realizing it for themselves with direct knowledge, in this very life, enter and dwell in the goal of asceticism or the goal of Brahmanhood. They don't get off the wheel. That's what that means. But those ascetics and Brahmins who understand aging and death, its origin, cessation, and way leading to its cessation, and it goes through the whole list again. I consider these to be ascetics among ascetics and Brahmins among Brahmins. And these venerable ones, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge in this very life, enter and dwell in the goal of asceticism and the goal of Brahmanhood. So this is saying that the Four Noble Truths are in each link. So whenever you hear about the Four Noble Truths, it's actually referring to the links of dependent origination. Saying, good friend, the venerable Mahakohita delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Sariputta's words. Then he asked a further question. One who is wise, one who is wise, is said, friend, with reference to what was this said, one who is wise. One wisely understands, one wisely understands, friend, that is why it is said, one who is wise. What does one wisely understand? One wisely understands this is suffering. Now, almost all of the Mahayana, when they start talking, and I think it has, some of the Tibetans will do it this way too. They'll say life is suffering. And that is not correct understanding, because it's leading you away from your understanding of the links of dependent origination. The links of dependent origination are not something to mentally repeat necessarily. That's only intellectual knowledge. When you know and see, there's no words that will show you. You will understand. This is how that works. And when you see it for yourself, you're letting go of the analytical mind. Okay, this is suffering. One wisely understands this is the origin. One wisely understands this is a cessation. One wisely understands this is the way to the cessation. One wisely understands, one wisely understands, friend. That's why it said one who is wise. Consciousness. Consciousness is said, friend, with reference to what is consciousness said. It cognizes. It cognizes. What's the difference between recognize and cognize? Recognize. That means that you've done it in the past. That has memory involved with it. When you cognize something, you see it as it's actually happening. That is why consciousness is said What does it cognize? It cognizes this is pleasant. That means that there is the perception mixed in with that. And you'll find out more about that in just a minute. It cognizes this is painful. It cognizes this is neither painful nor pleasant. It cognizes, friend. That's why consciousness is said. Wisdom and consciousness, friend. Are these states conjoined or disjoined? And is it possible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them? Wisdom and consciousness, friends, these states are conjoined, not disjoined. And it's impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. For what one wisely understands, that one cognizes. And what one cognizes, that one wisely understands. That's why these states are conjoined, not disjoined, and it's impossible to separate each of these states from the other in order to describe the difference between them. Now, he just got through saying it's impossible to separate these states. And the next question is, what is the difference between wisdom and consciousness, these states that are conjoined, not disjoined? The difference, friend, between wisdom and consciousness, these states that are conjoined, not disjoined, is this. Listen closely. Wisdom is to be developed. Consciousness is to be fully understood. Okay, why is wisdom to be developed? It takes practice to be able to see how the links actually work. You have to develop that ability to see something that subtle. Feeling is said, friend, with reference to what is feeling said. It feels, friend, that's why feeling is said. What does it feel? It feels pleasure, it feels pain, it feels neither pain nor pleasure. It feels, friend, that's why feeling is said. Perception is said, friend, with reference to what is perception said. It perceives, friend. That is why perception is said. What does it perceive? Now, perceive actually means putting the name on it. This is a painful feeling. These are conjoined, you'll see. It perceives blue, so he's talking about color. It perceives yellow, it perceives red, it perceives white, the colors of the Buddhist flag. It perceives, friend, that's why perception is said. Feeling, perception, and consciousness, friend, are these states conjoined or disjoined? And is it possible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them? Feeling, perception, and consciousness, friend, these states are conjoined, not disjoined. And it's impossible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them. Listen closely. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one cognizes. You got it? That is why these states are conjoined, not disjoined, that it's impossible to separate each of these states from the others in order to describe the difference between them. Knowable by mind alone. The key word here is alone. Friend, what can be known by purified mind consciousness? Released from the five faculties. What are they? Infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, neither perception nor non-perception. Mind alone. That means you don't have a body. Right? Yeah, right. Except when you have a pain, and then you take it, oh, I have a pain in my back, I have a pain in my bottom, whatever it happens to be. Friend, by purified mind consciousness released from the five faculties, the base of infinite space can be known thus. Space is infinite. The base of infinite consciousness can be known thus. Consciousness is infinite. The base of nothingness can be known thus. There is nothing. Friend, with what does one understand a state that can be known? Friend, one understands a state that can be known with the eye of wisdom. What does that actually mean? That means that you see what can be known without any identification, without taking it personally. This is just a state that arose by itself. Some of you are starting to see how you go from one level to the next level, and it's like you didn't have anything to do with it. You were just staying with your object of meditation, and all of a sudden there was a change. So it's a real important fact for you to understand that meditation pain is a hindrance, just like restlessness is a hindrance, just like sloth and torpor is a hindrance. Going to another section. This is the Bojanga Sutta. Okay. This is number 53 in the Bojanga Sutta, Samyutta. Monks, when wanderers of other sects speak thus, they should be asked, friend, when the mind becomes sluggish, which factors of awakening is it untimely to develop on that occasion, and which factors of awakening is it timely to develop on that occasion? Then, friends, when mind becomes excited, Which factors of awakening is it untimely to develop on that occasion, and which factors of awakening is it timely to develop on that occasion? Being asked thus, those wanderers would not be able to reply, and further, they would not meet, or they would meet with vexation. What for? Because they would not be within their domain. I do not see anyone, monks, in this world with its devas, brahmas, and mara, in this generation with ascetics and brahmins, its devas and humans, who could satisfy the mind with an answer to these questions except the Tathagata or a disciple of the Tathagata, or one who has heard it from them. So you're in a pretty elite group. The sluggish mind, on an occasion, when mind becomes sluggish, it's untimely to develop the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of collectedness, the awakening factor of equanimity. For what reason? Because mind is sluggish, and it's difficult to arouse it with those things. Suppose, monks, a man wants to make a small fire flare up. If he throws wet grass, wet cow dung, wet timber onto it, sprays it with water, and scatters the soil over it, would he be able to make that small fire flare up? No, venerable sir. So too, on that occasion, when the mind becomes sluggish, it's untimely to develop the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of collectedness, the awakening factor of equanimity. For what reason? Because the mind is sluggish and it's difficult to arouse it with these things. What is it timely to do? On an occasion when mind becomes sluggish, it's timely to develop the awakening factor of examination of your experience. How does it arise? What comes up first? What comes up after that? The awakening factor of energy, the awakening factor of joy. For what reason? Because the mind is sluggish and it's easy to arouse it with those things. Suppose a man wants to make a small fire flare up. He throws dry grass, dry cow dung, dry timber into it, blows on it, and does not scatter soil over it. Would he be able to make that small fire flare up? Well, of course. So too, monks, on an occasion when mind becomes sluggish, it's timely to develop the awakening factor of examination of your experience. Awakening factor of energy. When you take and look at how this process works, you naturally start building up your energy. And when you start building up your energy, you start feeling joy arise. These things are interconnected. For that reason, because mind is sluggish and it's easy to arouse these things. On an occasion, monk, when mind becomes excited, it's untimely to develop the awakening factor of examination of your experience, the awakening factor of energy, and the awakening factor of joy. For what reason? Because mind is excited. Monks, it's difficult to calm it down with those things. Suppose a man wants to extinguish a great bonfire. If he throws dry grass, dry cow dung, and dry timber into it and blows on it, and does not scatter soil over it, would he be able to extinguish that great bonfire? No, sir. So, on an occasion when mind becomes excited, it's untimely to develop the awakening factor of examination of your experience. The awakening factor of energy, the awakening factor of joy. For what reason? Because mind is excited. It's difficult to calm it down with those things. Now, when restlessness comes, do not move your body for any reason. But it hurts. Don't care. Meditation pain. When you start sitting longer, of course, there's going to be some times when mind gets tense and tight. Because it throws up all kinds of resistance to your doing that. So you're going to feel painful feeling. But you don't have a body. Oh, but it sure feels like I have a body. Every morning, don't you read, mind is the forerunner of all states? What does that mean? What does forerunner mean? It means it's always in the foreground. Mind is first, always. And when you are in an arupa jhana, then you don't have a body. It's all mind made, feeling, perception, formations, all of those things. Okay, on an occasion, when the mind becomes excited, it's timely to develop the awakening factor of tranquility. Imagine that, would you? The awakening factor of collectedness, the awakening factor of equanimity. Sometimes I will suggest to people to use the awakening factor of tranquility. Other times I will tell them to bring up the awakening factor of equanimity. As you start to have more balance in your mind without that subtle aversion to it, it doesn't matter whether it's there or not. You recognize it for what it is. It's just a mental pain. Suppose, monk, a man wants to extinguish a great bonfire. If he throws wet grass, wet cow dung, and wet timber into it and sprays it with water and scatters soil over it, would he be able to extinguish a great bonfire? Well, depending on how hot it is, I have thrown wet wood on a bonfire and it didn't slow it down much. But if you do the other things with it, it might. So too, on an occasion when mind becomes excited, it is timely to develop the awakening factor of tranquility. The awakening factor of stillness. Just bring that feeling into your mind. Stillness. Complete calm. Equanimity. Not fighting with it, Just allow it to be there. It will calm down. It has to be the feeling. This is a feeling meditation. It's not a mental meditation. Why should we bring up these three awakening factors? Because mind is excited. And it's easy to calm it down with those things. But mindfulness, monks, I say, is always useful. So, we just got rid of all of our hindrances, right? We know how to do it. Friend, what is the purpose of wisdom? The purpose of wisdom, friend, is direct knowledge. Its purpose is full of understanding. Its purpose is abandoning. Okay? Friend, how many conditions are there for the arising of right view? Friend, there are two conditions for the arising of right view. The voice of another and wise attention. These are the two conditions for the arising of right view. We're not talking about my voice. This is the Buddha's voice we're using. Friend, by how many factors is right view assisted when it has deliverance of mind for its path? No. Magga, path. Deliverance of mind for its path and fruition. When it has deliverance of mind by wisdom for its path, and deliverance by wisdom for its path and fruition. Friend, right view is assisted by five factors. When it has deliverance of mind for its fruit, deliverance of mind for its path, deliverance of mind for its path and fruition. When it has deliverance by wisdom for its path, deliverance by wisdom for its path and fruition. Here, friend, right view is assisted by virtue, learning, discussion, serenity, that means the jhana practice, and insight, which you have insights coming up to you all the time. Not in the systematic way that's described with other kinds of practice. The insights you have here are the insights you get when you see that you've been holding on to something. You've been holding on to a view, or you've been holding on to a longing for something to happen in a particular way. It's seeing that this is blocking me, so you let it go. That's what insights are all about. And you will see insights into the links of dependent origination arising, but you'll see them without having to have a lot of figuring out. You will automatically know when you start seeing them. That's what I was talking about this morning. Right view is assisted by these five factors for deliverance of mind for its path, deliverance of mind for its path and fruition. It has deliverance by wisdom for its path and deliverance by wisdom for its path and fruition. Friend, how many kinds of being are there? Now, being is bhava, and I've been giving you the definition of habitual tendency. Actually, I'm only talking about the first kind of being, the sense sphere being, when I'm doing that. But the reason that I'm doing that is because it's much easier to grasp and understand when you have a habitual tendency coming up of always acting and reacting instead of responding. That's why I do that. But I'm going to use the word being here. There are these three kinds of being, friend: the sense sphere being, the material, fine material being. Fine material being means Devaloka and Brahmaloka. An immaterial being. Immaterial being is getting into the different states of, or bases of, infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, neither perception nor non-perception. That's immaterial being. No material at all. Friend, how is renewal of being in the future generated? Friend, renewal of being in the future is generated through delighting in this and that on the part of beings who are hindered by ignorance, they don't understand about dependent origination, and fettered by craving. They don't relax and let that craving go. Friend, how is renewal of being in the future not generated? Friend, the fading away of ignorance with the arising of true knowledge, seeing the links of dependent origination, and with the cessation of craving. Renewal of being in the future is not generated. What am I trying to show you here? Okay. Now we get into the first jhana. Friend, what is the first jhana? Here, friend, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. A monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought, with joy and happiness born of seclusion. This is called the first jhana. Friend, how many factors does a first jhana have? Friend, the first jhana has five factors. Here, when a monk has entered upon the first jhana, there occur thinking, examining thought, joy, happiness, and unification of mind. That is how the first jhana has five factors. Friend, how many factors are abandoned in the first jhana, and how many factors are possessed? Friend, in the first jhana, five factors are abandoned, and five factors are possessed. Here, when a monk has entered upon the first jhana, sensual desire is abandoned, ill will is abandoned, sloth and torpor are abandoned, restlessness and anxiety are abandoned, and doubt is abandoned. Well, that's five hindrances, isn't it? That's why your mind becomes pure, because you don't have any hindrance arise while you're in the jhana. When a hindrance arises while you're sitting in the first jhana, you're not in the first jhana anymore. You're caught with a hindrance. And then you have to deal with that by using the six R's and get back to the first jhana. And there occurred thinking, examining thought, joy, happiness, and unification of mind. That is how the first jhana have five factors are abandoned and five factors are possessed. The five faculties. Friend, these faculties each have a separate field, a separate domain, and do not experience each other's field and domain. That is the eye faculty, ear faculty, nose faculty, tongue faculty, and body faculty. You don't see with your tongue. Right? You don't hear with your eye. That's what that's saying. You have a different domain for each one of those five things. Now, these five faculties each have a separate field, a separate domain, not experiencing each other's field and domain. What is their resort? What experiences their fields and domains? Friend, these five faculties each have a separate field and a separate domain and do not experience each other's field and domain. That is the eye faculty, ear faculty, nose faculty, tongue faculty, and body faculty. Now these five faculties, each having a separate field, a separate domain, not experiencing each other's field and domain, have mind as their resort. Mind experiences their fields and domains. So it's all mind-made, isn't it? Friend, as of these five faculties, that is the eye faculty, ear faculty, nose faculty, tongue faculty, and the body faculty, what do these five faculties stand independence on? Friend, as to these five faculties, that is the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body faculty, these five faculties stand independence on vitality. Friend, what does vitality stand in dependence on? Vitality stands in dependence on heat. Friend, what does heat stand in dependence on? You're going to love this answer. Heat stands in dependence on vitality. Just now, friend, we understood the Venerable Sariputta to have said vitality stands in dependence on heat. And now we understand him to say heat stands in dependence on vitality. How should the meaning of these statements be regarded? In that case, I shall give you a simile, for some wise men here understand the meaning of a statement by means of a simile. Just as when an oil lamp is burning, its radiance is seen in dependence on its flame, and its flame is seen in dependence on its radiance. so too vitality stands in dependence on heat, and heat stands in dependence on vitality. Okay? Friend, are vital formation things that can be felt, or are vital formations one thing and things can be felt another? Vital formations, friend, are not things that can be felt. If vital formation were things that can be felt, then a monk who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness would not be seen to emerge from it. Why? There's no perception, feeling, or consciousness. There is no feeling there, right? Because vital formations are one thing and things that can be felt another. A monk who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness can be seen to emerge from it. Friend, when this body is bereft of how many states, is it then discarded and forsaken, left lying senseless like a log? Friend, when this body is bereft of three states, vitality, heat, and consciousness, it is then discarded and forsaken, left lying senseless like a log. Friend, what is the difference between one who is dead, who has completed his time, and a monk who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness? Friend, in the case of one who is dead, who has completed his time, his bodily formations have ceased and subsided. His verbal formations have ceased and subsided. His mental formations have ceased and subsided. His vitality is exhausted, and his heat has been dissipated, and his faculties are fully broken up. In the case of a monk who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, his bodily formations have ceased and subsided. His verbal formations have ceased and subsided. His mental formations have ceased and subsided, but his vitality is not exhausted, and his heat has not been dissipated, and his faculties become exceptionally clear. You hear me talk about having radiance and seeing people that are doing the meditation and their face becomes very radiant. A person that can get into and sit in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness for a period of time, you see that glow very, very strongly. It's really inspiring to be around. It's why the artists make pictures of people they consider to be saints with that glow, that halo around them. Anytime you see anyone that has a very radiant face, give them something. Give them a gift. It will come back to you many, many wonderful ways and many, many times. I have some students that are actively practicing sitting in that state. And they had to tell their families not to worry if they saw them sitting or lying down, however they're doing that practice, if they don't see them breathing. Don't worry. If they feel the body, there'll still be some heat. So just don't worry. Leave me alone. Don't call an ambulance. When they come out of that, even if it's just for a short period of time of 15 or 20 minutes, their face is absolutely beautiful. There's not a line in their face at all. There's just this incredible radiance coming off of their face. Very nice. This is the difference between one who is dead and has completed his time and a monk who has entered upon the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. Friend, how many conditions are there for the attainment of neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind? Now we're talking about the fourth jhana. Friend, there are four conditions for the attainment of neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. Here, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain and the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a monk enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. These are the four conditions for the attainment of neither painful nor pleasant deliverance of mind. Friend, how many conditions are there for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind? Signless deliverance of mind means no feeling, perception, or consciousness at that time. And without consciousness, you're not going to know you're in that till you come out. It's going to be complete relief. Nothing to disturb you at all. When you come out of that state, it's like a flower opening up. All of a sudden, that state isn't there anymore, and then signs start coming up. Normal kind of consciousness, but uplifted, happy. Friend, there are two conditions for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind: non-attention to all signs and attention to the signless element. That's kind of funny saying it that way. It's not like you put your attention on the signless deliverance of mind. It's like it happens when you're not paying attention to any other signs. These are the two conditions for the attainment of the signless deliverance of mind. Friend, how many conditions are there for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind? Friend, there are three conditions for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind: non-attention to all signs, attention to the signless element, and the prior determination of its duration. That's one of the reasons that I'd like for you to practice getting up at a time you tell your body to get up. Okay? When you can do that pretty regularly and hit it exactly, you're just at the start of the determination. But it's a helpful tool to train your mind to be able to say, I'm going to sleep for this long a time. And I'm going to wake up at this time to the minute. And you do. That's the start of the determination. It gets a lot more precise when you start working with developing your mastery of going in and out of jhana and the arupa jhanas. These are the three conditions for the persistence of the signless deliverance of mind. You can sit up to 7 days. You have to make a determination when you're going to come out. I have one student that before I left, I told him I want him to sit for, I just made up a number, 2 days and 6 hours and 24 minutes and 14 seconds. And he hit it. That means his determination is pretty good. Friend, how many conditions are there for the emergence of the signless deliverance of mind? There are 2 conditions for the emergence of the signless deliverance of mind. Attention to all signs and non-attention to the signless element. These are the 2 conditions for the emergence of the signless deliverance of mind. Friend, the immeasurable deliverance of mind, that means the Brahma Viharas, the deliverance of mind through nothingness, the deliverance of mind through voidness, and the signless deliverance of mind. Are these states different in meaning and different in name? Or are they one in meaning and different in name only? Friend, the immeasurable deliverance of mind, the deliverance of mind through nothingness, the deliverance of mind through voidness, the signless deliverance of mind. There is a way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name, and there is a way in which they are one in meaning and different in name only. What, friend, is the way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name? Here, a person abides pervading 1/4 with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the 2/4, likewise, the 3rd, likewise, the 4th. Does this start to sound familiar? Likewise, above and below and all around and everywhere, and to all as to himself. That kind of sound like the 6 directions? Amazing, isn't it? How would I come up with something like that? He abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He abides pervading 1/4 of a mind imbued with compassion. He abides pervading 1/4 of a mind imbued with joy. He abides pervading one quarter of a mind imbued with equanimity. Now this is talking about doing the six directions in each of the Brahma Viharas, taking that feeling as your object of meditation and radiating it in the six directions, and then radiating it in all directions at the same time. Likewise, the second, the third, and the fourth, so below, above, around, and everywhere. He abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. This is called the immeasurable deliverance of mind. And what, friends, is a deliverance of mind through nothingness? Here, with the complete surmounting of the base of infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing, nothing to see outside of mind. A monk enters upon and abides in the base of nothingness. This is called the deliverance of mind through nothingness. What, friends, is a deliverance of mind through voidness? Here a monk gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or an empty hut reflects thus. This is void of a self, or of what belongs to a self. This is called the deliverance of mind through voidness. And that you've heard me talk about, and I practiced that for about 6 months with all of the thoughts and feelings that came up. Made mine very much more balanced, at ease. Emotional things didn't even start to arise while I was doing that. After I quit for a while, I had them coming up again. But I was able to see the impersonal nature of things much more easily and not take things so personally and get angry at somebody or get worried about something. It doesn't arise in my mind very often at all. If it does, I catch it pretty quickly. And what, friends, is the signless deliverance of mind? Here, with non-attention to all signs, a monk enters upon and abides in the signless collectedness of mind. This is called the signless deliverance of mind. This is the way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name. And what, friend, is the way in which these states are one in meaning and different in name only? Lust is the maker of measurement. Hate is the maker of measurement. Delusion is the maker of measurement. In a monk whose taints are destroyed, has abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with, so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Of all the kinds of immeasurable deliverance of mind, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now that unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, and void of delusion. Now isn't that amazing? It's saying that it's void of craving. Oh, isn't that nice? When you don't have craving in your mind doesn't measure. Doesn't get caught up in good and bad. Has true, honest balance in it all the time. Lust is a something. Hatred is a something. Delusion is a something. In a monk whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with so that they're no longer subject to future arising. Of all the kinds of deliverance of mind through nothingness, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now that unshakable deliverance of mind is void of lust, void of hate, and void of delusion. Lust is a maker of signs. Hate is a maker of signs. Delusion is a maker of signs. In a monk whose taints are destroyed, these are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with, so they're no longer subject to future arising. Of all the kinds of signless deliverance of mind, this unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. Now that unshakable deliverance of mine is void of lust, void of hate, and void of delusion. In this is the way in which these states are one in meaning and different in name only. That's what the Venerable Sariputta said. The Venerable Mahakohita was satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Think deeply about that. Lust is a something. And why is it a something? Because I want. Hatred is a something. Why is it a something? Because I don't want. Delusion is a something. Why is it something? You're taking it personally. I am that. So when you start realizing that this is how that process actually causes so much pain, because of the craving that keeps arising over and over again, you'll get more and more enthusiastic with using the six R's. And you'll start to use the six R's more naturally all the time. When you see the true advantage of not getting caught up in your restlessness or your dullness of mind, not getting caught up. You see, the hindrances don't just come one at a time. They like to gang up on you. So you get restlessness arising, you don't like it. Or another form of restlessness is planning. What am I going to do when I get off retreat? Who am I going to tell about this? And you start thinking of, well, I'm going to say this to them, and I'm going to tell them that. And, oh, this is going to be so much fun. That is restlessness that's arising. And it can be pleasurable, which means there's lust there. But there's always the identification with those kind of thoughts and feelings. So generally people, when I tell them before the end of the retreat, I tell them, let go of the planning mind. Don't get caught up in your plans of what you're going to do when you get off retreat. You already know what you're going to do. You're either going to drive somewhere, or you're going to have a ride somewhere, and then you're going to get on a vehicle and go somewhere else. You're going to see different people as soon as you get home. If you start thinking about that now, you're caught in restlessness. So you tell yourself, I don't need to think about this right now. I'll think about it later. My job as a meditator is simply to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. Sometimes you have a good idea. I've got to go do this when I get back. Just put a red flag in mentally in your mind. It'll come up again. So you don't need to plan who you're going to see and what you're going to say when you see them. Because it isn't going to come out the way you think anyway. So it's a waste of time. I had a great example of that. I was in Burma. They told all the foreign monks, because there was a revolution happening in Burma at the time, and they were shooting people, they told all the foreign monks, you gotta leave. And it was before the end of the rains retreat, so they went and talked to them and say, well, we can't let them go before the end of the rains retreat. We don't want them to break their retreat. So we had an extra week. And boy, I had some great ideas of who I was going to see and what we were going to do and how I was going to convince him of helping me, this other monk. And I spent a whole week doing that. And it was enjoyable. Oh, it was great fun. And I went back to Thailand and I looked this monk up and he had disrobed and gotten married. So I had a whole week of just nonsense planning. What a waste of time I had. And I didn't recognize it as that. I just got into it. Oh yeah, this is going to be good. So I learned the lesson from that. You can project what you're going to say to this person or that person, but as soon as you get up to them and start talking, it doesn't come out even close to what you thought it would be. So don't get caught up in it. Okay? So, never ask me how long should I sit when I go home. You won't like the answer. I do recommend that if you can sit at 2 hours at one sitting, if you have the time to do that, I strongly recommend you do that, because you'll keep progressing with 2 hours. It's not going to be as fast as it is here, of course, but you're still going to start progressing. If you only sit for 1 hour a day, the progress is going to be very slow. I recommend very strongly that you sit in the morning. It's a nice way to start the day. Your mind is very refreshed from sleeping, you're ready to go, but don't get out of bed and try to sit, because you'll go back to sleep. Get up and do your morning things. If you're going to eat, then eat your breakfast. If you're going to take a shower, then take a shower. Whatever you're going to do. Then, as you're fully awake, then sit. If you wait until the evening, there's going to be distractions that come along and you'll say, I don't have time to meditate now, I'll do it tomorrow. And tomorrow comes and then there's another reason, and I'll do it tomorrow. I really want to do it, but you keep putting it off. And before long, it's 2 or 3 months and you haven't sat at all. Keep your 6 hours going. You are practicing the Eightfold Path when you're smiling. So smile. In Indonesia, I tell them that they have to smile all the time. And they come back with, if people see me smiling all the time, they'll think I'm crazy. So we can't smile all the time. And I'm going, no, you're making an excuse. I'm talking about a real smile. I'm not just talking about smiling with your lips while you're thinking hate thoughts about somebody else. I'm talking about real smile. It'll help your mindfulness immeasurably. Having fun with your life. Don't get serious with it. Oh, but this is a serious problem. It's only serious when you make it serious. And that gives you the permission to worry and become frustrated and become full of anxiety and all of that stuff. You can do that if you want, but watch how it makes you suffer. Don't do that. Be happy. Have fun. Laugh with things. Take joy in seeing a butterfly or a hummingbird or whatever beastie that comes around. So, keep your mind uplifted. Stop being critical. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu.